Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Five Bites Podcast. I'm your host, Rory Monahan. Coming up on this week's episode, the organization responsible for tracking vulnerabilities has itself confirmed they have been breached. Reports that HashiCorp, who make Terraform, are about to be acquired by IBM. And NASA performed an application update to a 46-year-old spacecraft that was 24 billion kilometers away. For this and more, keep listening to this episode of the podcast, which, as always, is brought to you by my sponsors, and that includes ControlUp, end-to-end digital experience management for the work-from-anywhere era. ControlUp, happy users, happy IT. And also brought to you by Netrix Policy Pack, where you use Group Policy, Policy Pack Cloud, or MDM, to remove local admin rights, manage and lock down applications, Java, browsers, and mitigate ransomware, plus more. And of course, also brought to you by Numescent, the inventors of the first and only cloud-native container management platform for Windows desktops. If you enjoy the show each week, you have these awesome sponsors to thank. And now for some news. Earlier this week, there was speculation by multiple outlets stating that IBM was set to acquire HashiCorp. Off the back of the reported rumors, HashiCorp stock surged 24%, giving it a market value of $6.1 billion. IBM confirmed in midweek their intention to acquire HashiCorp for $6.4 billion. IBM has completed 9 acquisitions just in 2023 alone. To some, this has been seen as a further blow to the community, and not to badmouth IBM, but them taking over the company responsible for Terraform and Packer, which are pretty heavily relied on by EUC and DevOps communities, is worrisome, as large companies have a mixed track record when it comes to acquiring smaller tech firms. HashiCorp championed the acquisition as a way to accelerate HashiCorp's mission and expand access to their products to an even broader set of developers and enterprises. They said the acquisition of HashiCorp by IBM creates a comprehensive end-to-end hybrid cloud platform built for AI-driven complexity. The combination of each company's portfolio and talent will deliver clients' extensive application infrastructure and security lifecycle management capabilities. Upon close, HashiCorp is expected to drive significant synergies for IBM, including across multiple strategic growth areas like Red Hat, WatsonX, data security, IT automation, and consulting. For example, they say the powerful combination of Red Hat's Ansible automation platform's configuration management and Terraform's automation will simplify provisioning and configuration of applications across hybrid cloud environments. The two companies also anticipate an acceleration of HashiCorp's growth initiatives by leveraging IBM's world-class go-to-market strategy, scale, and reach that operates in more than 175 countries across the globe. They'll be expanding their total addressable market and expect growth combined with operating efficiencies. So we'll have to wait and see. I will say in their press release, they do make a compelling case why IBM is a good spot for HashiCorp. But again, you know, we look at those large tech organizations and acquisitions in recent years, and it doesn't tell a great story. So hopefully this is going to be an outlier and this is going to be different. So I guess we'll wait and see. So this is a very short story, but I did want to put it near the top of the show because it is pretty important. I saw copies of an email, which, yeah, I have not actually had this email delivered to me. So I have not got firsthand information, just secondhand information from people in the community sharing a copy of the email on Twitter. But it appears that VMware's divested EUC and VMware have reached an agreement whereby customers who continue to use the likes of Horizon and their DAS offering will be able to leverage VMware vSphere going forward as a combined product offering. There wasn't a whole lot of technical details or even just business specifics and costing and all that stuff on this, but it looks like it's going to be current par for the course and business as usual. Which should hopefully be a welcome news to those existing Horizon customers. Mitra disclosed that they were breached by a cyber attack that leveraged Ivanti Connect secure zero-day vulnerabilities. It appears the attack was confined to a research network, and their core and partner networks were spared from the attack. They stated, quote, "No organization is immune from this type of cyber attack, not even one that strives to maintain the highest cybersecurity possible," end quote. So obviously this is not a great look, because this is an organization that, you know, I quote every single week on the podcast. You know, they're responsible for these CVEs for tracking vulnerabilities, and they themselves have been found to be victims of a cyber attack. Now, the statement they released is absolutely true. You know, this whole zero-day philosophy that organizations are implementing, I think, is a good approach, because you should assume it's not a case of if you will be breached and attacked, it is a case of when. So you need to assume that someone's going to get into your organization and keep all the goodies away from them once they're in. In a positive continuous trend, a study by Coveware shows companies are increasingly refusing to pay extortion demands, leading to a record low of 28% of companies paying ransoms in the first quarter of 2024. Coveware reports a 32% quarter-over-quarter drop in the average ransomware payment, which is now at $381,980, and a 25% quarter-over-quarter increase in the median ransom payment, which stands at $250,000. BleepyComputer.com reports this simultaneous drop in average and rise in median ransom payments indicates a decrease in high-figure payments and an increase in moderate amounts. This could be caused by ransomware gangs demanding a lower or more moderate ransom payments. So it could be a case that maybe there's more attacks, but the ransomware payments are less, so people are still paying the ransoms, but the total is falling because the actual ransom is lower. But, I mean, this is a continuing trend, and organizations have been taking approach more and more to just not negotiate and not pay any ransom, which is the correct approach. Unfortunately, the United Health Group has confirmed that it paid a ransom to cybercriminals to protect sensitive data stolen during the Optum ransomware attack in late February. The Black Cat ransomware gang claimed the attack, alleging to have stolen 6 terabytes of sensitive patient data. There was no confirmation of the amount paid. There were previously rumors that it was a $22 million ransom, or at least a $22 million ransom was paid to this gang, but it's not confirmed by United Health that this was the payment. And they said, quote, "A ransom was paid as part of the company's commitment to do all it could to protect patient data from disclosure," end quote. So, I mean, I just covered the fact that, you know, ransoms are being paid less frequently now, it seems, which is the best approach to have. But I could also understand when an organization is trying to protect patient data and sensitive data that they may be inclined to pay the ransom. And for their part, it does seem that the data that was leaked for this ransomware attack has been taken down by the cyber gang. So hopefully this is the end of it. Although, unfortunately, they say that when you pay a ransom, you put a target on your back because other cyber gangs know you're willing to pay, so they're likely to attack you as well. So hopefully that's not the case, because it is terrible when healthcare organizations are the ones who are getting attacked. I mean, it's bad when everyone gets attacked, but healthcare in particular. Ars Technica has reported that amid questioning from antitrust officials in the European Union, Broadcom announced that they have already given support extensions for some VMware perpetual license holders, but CEO Hock Tan reiterated that the controversial changes, like the end of perpetual licensing, are not going away. While Hock Tan did not mention European regulators as the reason behind extending existing support agreements with some perpetual license customers, Ars Technica reported that several trade groups recently reached out to the European Commission and urged them to take appropriate action against Broadcom, which they accused of implementing VMware business practices that resulted in steeply increased prices, non-fulfillment of previous contractual agreements, and Broadcom refusing to maintain security conditions for perpetual licenses. So even though it was not pointed out in Hawk 10's statement, it sure seems like the regulators had something to do with it. Just putting two and two together. The Federal Trade Commission in the U.S. has issued a rule to promote competition by banning non-compete clauses nationwide, protecting the fundamental freedom of workers to change jobs, increasing innovation, and fostering new business formation. They stated, quote, "Non-compete clauses keep wages low, suppress new ideas, and rob the American economy of dynamism, including from the more than 8,500 new startups that would be created a year once non-competes are banned. The FTC's final rule to ban non-competes will ensure Americans have the freedom to pursue a new job, start a new business, or bring a new idea to market." End quote. The FCT estimates that the final rule banning non-competes will lead to new business formation growing by 2.7% per year, resulting in more than 8,500 additional new businesses created each year. The final rule is expected to result in higher earnings for workers, with estimated earnings increasing for the average worker by an additional $524 per year, and it's expected to lower healthcare costs by up to $194 billion over the next decade. In addition, the final rule is expected to help drive innovation, leading to an estimated average increase of 17,000 to 29,000 more patents each year for the next 10 years under the final rule. To me, like reading this, like first off, way to go, America, way to go, FTC. I think this is a great thing. I know I've been a victim of non-competes in the past myself, and I'm sure others have as well. But to actually see these numbers is pretty remarkable. I mean, I guess it makes sense with the American system where healthcare is tied to employment. If you have fewer employees, if you have fewer employers, but larger employers, and they're not necessarily negotiating the best terms with healthcare providers or insurance companies, then yeah, maybe the cost of healthcare is actually increased just by way of the fact that these non-competes exist. And certainly, it does stifle innovation and the ability for people to leave a company and then go maybe work in something closely aligned to what they did for that previous employer. So yeah, this gets a two thumbs up for me. I'm not sure how others feel about it, but my reaction is this is a positive. Apple has reportedly cut production of its Apple Vision Pro due to unexpectedly low demand, according to a report by IGN.com. I am surprised that they were surprised, as it says unexpectedly low demand. It costs $3,500 for this device, and we're in the middle of a cost of living crisis. So come on, Apple, read the room. Quick shout out just to congratulate all new and renewed Citrix CTPs. I saw the awesome Ray Davis is among the award category for this year for CTP. Hugely deserved. And I just wanted to wish my congratulations to all. Before I move away from community type news, EUC Unplugged took place last week in Scottsdale, Arizona. I learned a lot about some cool new AI products and services and a whole lot more. It was great to meet some in the community that I had not met in person before, like Bruce Payne and Tyler Miranda, to name just a couple. And of course, it was great to see some familiar faces and friends like Trenton Tai, Jim Moyle, Aaron Parker, my travel buddy, Shane O'Neill, Lee Jeffries, Tim Mangan, and so many more. The event completely sold out this year, and impressively, about 50% of attendees were at the event for their first time. I encourage everyone who is yet to attend to do so next time, assuming it goes ahead again. I'd like to say thank you to Steve Greenberg and his team for continuing to deliver a truly unique and awesome experience. Microsoft have shared a five-year strategic partnership to align with Coca-Cola's core technology strategy system-wide, which enables their adoption of leading-edge technology and fosters innovation and productivity globally, according to a joint press release. As part of the partnership, Coca-Cola has made $1.1 billion worth of commitment to the Microsoft Cloud and its generative AI capabilities. The collaboration underscores Coca-Cola's ongoing technology transformation underpinned by the Microsoft Cloud as Coca-Cola's globally preferred and strategic cloud and AI platform, according to this press release. So they mentioned things like the Azure OpenAI service and developing innovative generative AI use cases across their various business functions. They also mentioned the use of Copilot for Microsoft 365 in the press release. Something discussed in conversations I had at EUC Unplugged, which I just mentioned, was concern around so much focus on AI by Microsoft and worries that it could lead to stagnation of product features in their various product stacks whilst trying to integrate generative AI, which, as some suggested, is great and valuable, but more improvements are needed as a priority in products like Windows 365 and Azure Virtual Desktop and things that EUC relies on. You know, fixing bugs and shortcomings of products is also important, not just to focus on generative AI, which it seems like Microsoft may have to invest a lot of time and focus on Gen AI in order to get out ahead of the rest of the pack. It's understandable. It's just worrying that this trend is possibly going to happen and possibly innovation in our space may fall behind, or at least improvements in our space may fall behind in favor of pursuing this Gen AI journey. Finally, in the news for this week, several months ago, it was reported in the news that NASA's Voyager 1 craft was experiencing problems that meant it was no longer sending usable data. It started sending indecipherable gibberish instead, with Voyager 1 being over 24 billion kilometers away from Earth and already 46 years old, reporters assumed it had just reached its natural end. After months of troubleshooting, including trying the old turn it off and on again trick, the team noticed that activity from one part of the flight data system stood out from the rest of that garbled data they were getting back. While the signal wasn't in the format the Voyager team is used to seeing when the flight data system is functioning as expected, an engineer with NASA's Deep Space Network was able to decode it. The Deep Space Network is a system of radio antenna on Earth that helps the agency communicate with the Voyager probes and other spacecraft exploring the solar system. And the decoded signal included a readout of the entire flight data system's memory. And by investigating the readout, the team determined the cause of the issue. 3% of the flight data system's memory was corrupted. A single chip responsible for storing part of the system's memory, including some of the computer software code, was not working properly. While the cause of the chip's failure was unknown, it could be worn out or may have just hit an energetic particle from space, according to NASA. I mean, being worn out kind of makes sense after this length of time. The loss of the code on the chip caused Voyager 1's science and engineering data to be unusable, and since there was no way to repair the chip, the team opted to store the affected code from the chip elsewhere in the system's memory. While they could not pinpoint a location large enough to hold all of the code, they were able to divide the code into sections and store it in different spots within the flight data system. It wasn't enough just to move the sections either. They had to make code changes to ensure the existing functions remained working with these sections being moved around. They issued the changes to Voyager via a probe, which took 22 and a half hours to reach the craft. Amazing that an update to a spacecraft 24 billion kilometers away is quicker than some deployments from Intune, but I digress. The good news is on April 20th, they got the satisfaction of discovering these changes worked on the 46-year-old Voyager 1, and it is now sending usable data again. Absolutely incredible. Something as innocuous as deploying a patch or an update is something, you know, we do every week or many days now because of the frequency of patches required in day-to-day IT. But to hear about NASA doing it on a spacecraft so far away and with such a complicated issue as well is just remarkable. Such a cool story. But now this episode's scripts, tricks, and tips. Thanks to Lee Jeffries for this first one, who I believe shared this while he was traveling for work over in Florida. So, hey, keeping his eye on the ball while away. This was a Citrix community blog post on how to connect Power BI with DAS Monitor using OData and API clients. So Power BI integration with exported data for monitoring solutions is a big topic in organizations. So this is going to be one that interests a lot of people, I assume. Next up, thanks to Thorsten for this one, who shared this link to useful AD-related PowerShell commandlets. So this is a pretty comprehensive list of PowerShell commandlets that relate to Active Directory, and it's definitely one worth checking out if you work with PowerShell. Finally, this last one is also news, but due to the release cadence of my episodes, because I was traveling for EUC Unplugged, and I released an episode early last week, and it's kind of in its normal slot this week. You know, a lot of news has passed, and I feel like this release and this story is a little dated to cover as news now. But I will cover it as a tip instead, and that is that Citrix released a new Citrix Virtual Apps and Desktops LTSR version, which is version 7.2402. If you're running 1912 LTSR, which I think a lot of organizations still are, it will reach end of life by December of 2024. So do not sleep on that. Get moving. I think Citrix upgrades are relatively straightforward these days, so it shouldn't be too stressful to get moved to the new LTSR. There are some nice protocol enhancements and other features in this release, but don't let me tell you. My tip here is I suggest you check out Tom Poppelgaard's blog post that covers a lot about this release. Well, that's it for this episode of the podcast. Hopefully my voice is okay. People keep telling me I look exhausted this week because I'm severely jet lagged. If not, I apologize and things should be back to normal next week. And thank you so much for listening.